The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
While I support what happened in the Trump case because I think it's so extreme, I think these, as a private decision, these companies should have a big thumb on the scale favoring free speech, even speech from politicians who may represent ideas that are controversial and in some cases that are even racist or taking views that most of us would find to be abhorrent.
I'm Quinta Jurassic, senior editor at Lawfare. And this is the Lawfare Podcast, December 15th, 2022. Today, we're bringing you another episode of Arbiters of Truth, our series on the online information ecosystem. On November 19th, Twitter's new owner, Elon Musk, announced that he would be reinstating former President Donald Trump's account on the platform. Though so far, Trump hasn't taken Musk up on the offer, preferring instead to stay on his bespoke website, Truth Social. Meanwhile, Meta's oversight board has set a January 2023 deadline for the platform to decide whether or not to return Trump to Facebook following his suspension after the January 6 insurrection. How should we think through the difficult question of how social media platforms should handle the presence of a political leader who delights in spreading falsehoods and ginning up violence? Luckily for us, Stanford and UCLA recently held a conference on just that. Alan Rosenstein and I sat down with the conference's organizers, election law experts Rick Hassan and Nate Persily, to talk about whether Trump should be returned to social media, and if so, how. We debated the tangled issues of Trump's deplatforming and replatforming, and discussed whether and when Trump will break the seal and start tweeting again. It's the Lawfare Podcast, December 15th. Rick Hassan and Nate Persily on replatforming Trump on social media.
So, Nate and Rick, thanks for joining. You had a whole fabulous conference full of thoughtful analysis of whether Trump should come back to Twitter, shouldn't come back to Twitter. And then Elon Musk went and decided, based, as far as we can tell, on a Twitter poll, it's not the most scientific way of doing public surveys, that Trump should be reinstated. Not to stack the deck with the question, but is there any merit at all to how Musk went about making this decision? And did you anticipate that it would be done in such a procedure light way?
Well, you know, I mean, the first thing I'd say is that at the time we held our conference, I believe it wasn't clear that Musk was actually going to go through with the deal. He was trying to back out. And then all of a sudden he's in and making changes on the fly. So I really wasn't surprised at all once he actually went through with the purchase that he was going to do this, because he said he was going to do it. And I mean, I have no idea how scientific that Twitter poll is, especially given Musk's statement that Twitter was full of bots. And so who knows if there were bots voting, but I think the outcome was predetermined. He said he was going to restore Trump to Twitter if he bought the platform, and we should have believed him when he said it.
Yeah, I don't think that there's any reason to think that the poll was determinative here. And look, it's not like it was run like an election where we knew that it would end at a particular time and those would be the votes that were in. It was like, it was 51% at a given time. And so the people have spoken. And so then he gets reinstated. And so, look, there are plenty of legitimate reasons to replatform Trump. I don't think that the you know, a poll on Twitter is sort of the decisive fact, was either the decisive factor for Musk or would have been the decisive factor, you know, were we to design a process for reinstating him.
So I'm curious, Rick, in particular, to get your thoughts. What does it mean that Trump hasn't actually tweeted since being allowed to come back to the platform? He mostly seems to have stayed on his own platform, Truth Social, which, you know, is his, which is, I guess, nice for him, but he has much less reach, it seems. I mean, what do you think explains the fact that he's kind of refused the invitation?
As I understand it, he has a contractual obligation to be exclusive to Truth Social, at least for a time. And I read somewhere, I'm not sure if this is correct, that there's like a 6-hour time period and then he could go on to another platform. But, you know, that seems to lose its punch. If Truth Social ends up collapsing and there have been financial issues with that, then I expect he'll go back to Twitter. There's also, as Nate and I discussed with others at the conference, there's the upcoming decision by Facebook. They have to decide, thanks to a decision of their oversight board, whether to reinstate Trump, whether the conditions that caused his deplatforming have changed. And that's going to happen in early January. So he's going to have lots of opportunities. But I think the contract, more than anything else, is the reason that he's not tweeting right now.
I think that's right. But I also think that, you know, it's, if we get into the heat of a campaign, the reach of the audience is going to be too irresistible. Similarly, one thing we can't forget is that now that he is a candidate, he will likely try to use all these platforms to raise money. And so political advertising is as much a part of the kind of story here as organic tweeting or posting. So those are also some critical decisions that need to be made by the platforms, whether he's going to have essentially full rights that every other candidate would have. But I think that right now, yeah, there he doesn't see as big an advantage of tweeting what he has on Truth Social. But I imagine the calculus will change as he wants greater amplification.
So in short, so you don't, am I right that sort of neither of you take the fact that he has not come back to Twitter as really changing the importance of these ultimate decisions about whether or not he should be allowed? Because ultimately, you know, whether through breaking his contract or for some other reason, when given the opportunity, we should expect him to use all the platforms available at his disposal. I mean, that's sort of what I heard you saying, Nate.
Well, I agree. I think that is right. I think that nevertheless, I am surprised that even despite some of these contractual obligations, he hasn't returned to Twitter with a vengeance. But I think that that still might be in the offing. Now, I think it ends up being relevant to Facebook's decision, because right now, Trump's return to Twitter doesn't seem to have caused any of the harms that people had alleged would happen if he were returned to Twitter. And so if you're Facebook, then you're looking at this and you're saying, well, what, you know, what would really be the harm in doing so? I mean, that's just one factor among many. I mean, Facebook, I think, you know, is definitely ruining the day that it has to make this decision. It would prefer not to be the one to do that. But ultimately, I think all of the questions about the, not just the information environment, but the sort of security environment are going to be relevant to that decision.
Well, I would just add that it could be that Trump is holding back precisely because he doesn't want to jinx his chances of being brought back onto Facebook. I mean, who knows how calculating Trump actually is, but that would be a smart decision to make, to kind of let them replatform, because then the cost of taking him off again would be higher. And let's not forget, I think I made this point at our earlier conference, there's going to be a Republican House. They're going to have the subpoena power. They're going to be holding hearings on social media bias. They're going to be pulling in Facebook executives if Trump is not replatformed, and maybe even if he is replatformed. And so there's going to be a lot of political pressure for them to do it. So I fully expect, I'm willing to say it right here, I fully expect Trump will be replatformed in early January by Facebook, you know, barring some big news event with Trump before that time.
We're gonna hold you to that. We'll come back to you on that in early January. One point I want to dig into a little bit more is this question of the effectiveness of deplatforming, which is something that we've touched on a little bit. But Nate, that was something you spoke about at the conference, that removing Trump from these major platforms had actually been more effective than you had expected. And I completely agree with you there. I've been really struck by that. I mean, I think it's difficult maybe to disentangle removing Trump from Twitter versus removing him from the presidency. But I'd be curious if you could just talk a little bit more for the listeners about what has led you to that conclusion and how that affects the calculus that you think platforms might want to go through if they were thinking through these problems carefully.
So censorship works. That's one of the things that we've learned through this, which is that, yes, if you kick someone off the large platforms that where their audience gathers, that then they will not be able to work around in ways that we might have assumed. And so if you go back to the time of the deplatforming, I would have thought that either through Truth Social or through a separate blog or website, that the content that Trump would get out there would eventually be amplified either by his followers or allies on these other platforms. The platforms themselves actually acted against some of that attempt at circumvention. So maybe that's part of the story here. But it is remarkable, isn't it, that someone who really dominated social media for many years, then once the platforms kicked him out, was unable to access that audience and get amplify the message. Now, you're right that there are these confounding variables that he was no longer present. But remember that there was at least 3 weeks in there where he was deplatformed and seemed to be silent while he was president, right before the inauguration. And so I think that there's a lesson here, which is that as much as kind of information or communication has a kind of hydraulic relationship to these platforms where it always finds a crack in the sidewalk like water, that the friction that you add by deplatforming is considerable and that it's not so easy to replicate that audience on the outside.
I have a small quibble and a bigger quibble with what Nate said. The small quibble is I reject the language of censorship. I believe that censorship is something that a government does. So if I decide that, Nate sends me something to post on the election law blog and I decide not to post it, I don't think I'm censoring Nate. I think I'm making a decision of editorial discretion. Now, Nate has his own posting privileges, so he could get around that. I would reserve the language of censorship for decisions made by government actors. And I think private actors, just like Fox News can decide not to put me on, which they have, a private platform, it's not censorship if they decide not to carry some particular speech. My larger quibble is I just think it's impossible to know what would have happened, if Trump had not been deplatformed in terms of the reach of his stuff. Certainly it would have been less, but remember, Trump had just encouraged an insurrection and he gave that speech where he seemed to be, we love you all, where he seemed to be welcoming those who were rioting at the Capitol and threatening our government leadership. So, I don't know what it would have been. And the last point I'd make is that, remember, it was not just Trump that was deplatformed, but there were a number of other accounts that amplified Trump that also ended up losing privileges on Twitter. And they're all coming back. And so, it's not just Trump alone, but it's the kind of ecosystem. And there, a lot of the great research that came out of the project with Stanford and Washington, University of Washington, and others looking at how disinformation, election-related disinformation spread, pointed to what they called super spreaders of disinformation. So it was kind of a network of 20 or so accounts that were really responsible for the lion's share of amplifying this kind of stuff. So it's just really hard to know what would have happened. But I agree that taking him off took a lot of the oxygen away. And I too am somewhat surprised. I didn't think Truth Social was going to take off and be a major platform because it is so ideologically oriented. It was not going to be a mass-based platform. But I did think you'd end up seeing basically every Truth Social post being screenshot and posted on Twitter. And except for some journalists, you don't really see that so much.
So a follow-up for both of you, and I'll start with Rick and then go to Nate. To the extent that we can call it censorship, we can call it deplatforming, but to the extent that this, as both of you pointed out, did seem to work, at least in the short term, I'm curious whether you think that that supports either side, to the extent that there are sides in this debate more, right? The, well, it works, so we should do it when there's a real threat, the other side being it works, so we really shouldn't do it because we want, you know, robust discourse? Or do you think it just kind of heightens the contradictions, right? It doesn't help either side. It just makes this debate even more important and even more difficult on both sides.
Well, these are private decisions. If Elon Musk wants to include Trump and Facebook wants to exclude him, I think that's totally up to them. I don't think that there should be government regulation. I don't think the government regulation of who should be on a platform and who shouldn't is even constitutional under the First Amendment. Yeah, others disagree. But so I come to this as a private decision. What should they do? And I think that it should be a last resort. There should be a series of warnings. There should be clear rules as to what's allowed. And you should only deplatform a politician in the event that the politician is engaged in a repeated pattern of advocating violence, propagating hate speech, or continually spreading election disinformation. That would be the line. You know, if I were making a policy choice as a private actor of where I would draw the line, I think that's the best way, because this does show the danger. And I worry about this less in the United States, but in other countries around the world, it does show the danger of using the pretext of some kind of political crisis as a means to silence political opposition. So while I support what happened in the Trump case, because I think it's so extreme, I think these, as a private decision, these companies should have a big thumb on the scale favoring free speech, even speech from politicians who may represent ideas that are controversial and in some cases that are even racist or taking views that most of us would find to be abhorrent.
So on the larger question as to how we think about the kind of aftermath of deplatforming to inform the decision of whether to deplatform, I still think that, you know, the fact that we learned that deplatforming works, right, that it has the intended effect of removing the audience and amplification, you know, that was always the assumption of the platforms when they made this decision. That's why they took it so seriously and were concerned about it. And so, you know, it is an effective tool to be used against clear violators of platform policies. One thing I would sort of caution people, though, is to think about what standard Trump violated and then how many other people would violate that standard as well. Because if it's election disinformation, the kind of hate speech that he engaged in, which is not like the core hate speech that violates the policies. I mean, I don't want to sort of debate and wordsmith it, but the point is that the kind of language that appeared on Trump's Twitter account or other social media feeds is exactly the same as tens of thousands of other accounts. And so we can say, all right, well, you deplatform Trump because he has the possibility of causing greater harm because of how big his audience is. But then that's a new factor, right, that needs to be weighed into this about what the likelihood of harm is to as a result. And that, of course, is what the platforms were focusing on in the aftermath of January 6th. But as we explained at the conference, or as I explained at the conference, you know, the actual reasons for why he was deplatformed remain somewhat murky, right? What was the speech that like put him over the edge? And so the fact that he said, as Rick was mentioning, he has a video that says, "We love you, go on home," right? That's usually not going to violate either the glorification of violence policy or the incitement policies, right? I mean, if your average person says something like this. And so, you know, you've got to read a lot into that language, which is fair. And the platforms did it in order to find him to be violative.
I would add that the moment when Trump encouraged people to come for wild protests in D.C., that's the moment I called for him to be deplatformed. And it wasn't January 6th, which I think it was appropriate to deplatform on January 6th. But I think once he started veiled threats of violence in that way, and given his reach, again, private decision, your mileage may vary. My view is that was reason enough to take him off the platform.
Well, again, so you say the veiled threats, right? So the question is, how thick does the veil need to be? And so, yes, if he says, come, let's storm the Capitol and kill people, that's clear. He doesn't say that. He says, you know, come to Washington, it's going to be wild. Now, again, I agree with you that, look, the platforms have the power to do this, but they have to come up with a policy
that would get at all of the bad actors that we're talking about without essentially, you know, censoring, I use the word censoring, without deplatforming a sizable share of Congress, frankly, right? Because that's what one should be concerned about, is that you're going to have a large internet platform that's basically going to say that anyone who supports this candidate or who has spoken, you know, similar to this candidate is going to not allowed an account on the platform.
Yeah, one quick thing about the Will Be Wild tweet, and then I know Alan has a follow-up. I think it's very notable that the January 6th committee in its hearings over the summer was explicitly pointing to that tweet about January 6th, the Be There, Will Be Wild, as something that, in retrospect, looking at all of the data after having conducted this investigation, was really a sort of turning point or inflection point, whatever you want to call it, in terms of people, extremist groups gathering to, you know, starting to plan to attend the rallies and attack the Capitol on the 6th. Of course, the platforms are making this call in the moment without having the benefit of all of that work. But I do think it's interesting that I certainly, you know, looking at that tweet at the moment, thought, oh, that seems bad, but wouldn't have pinpointed it as, you know, if I were Twitter, this is the moment where I would have banned him. In retrospect, though, it does seem like it was hugely significant. And I think that kind of points to the difficulty of making these calls in real time.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress. It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Hey, Lawfare listeners, Ben Wittes here. Want to tell you about the first time I got a report from the folks at Delete Me. It was shortly after I started using the service back in 2022, and they sent me their first privacy report. I have since gotten 8 others, and it contained some shocking information. They had removed my data from 56 separate data brokers, that this had included 133 separate records, including 621 individual pieces of personal information. The data broker with the most information about me was a company I'd never heard of called People by Name. And here's the thing. Since then, every couple of months, I've gotten another privacy report from Delete Me, and it always contains more information that they have removed from the data brokers about me. In the second report, they informed me they had removed my stuff from 41 data brokers and that the one with the most information about me was called HLEC. I have no idea what HLEC is. So the other day, I got my latest report and it includes 15 more data brokers with my personal information, 113 pieces of personally identifiable information. Big culprit this time is something called My Life. Well, I want to tell you that they don't have My Life anymore. And that is why I recommend Delete Me. As this little anecdote shows, there's a lot of my data out there. And these companies keep acquiring it and making it available to anybody who can pay. And I have slept a little bit more easily ever since I found a solution to this problem. And I want to stress, as I do every time, that I started using this before Delete Me started advertising with Lawfare. Delete Me finds and removes any personal information you don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. And that's the point of this little story, that, you know, they keep coming back. You can get it removed once,
but they'll put it back. And then Delete Me comes and takes it off again. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. Delete Me sends you regular personalized privacy reports, just like the ones I've been describing, showing what info they found where they found it, and what they removed. And critically, as this story reflects, it isn't just a one-time service. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. It does all the hard work of wiping you and your family's personal information off the web. Data brokers hate Delete Me, which is why I like it. Your profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special discount for our listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use promo code lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code lawfare20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/lawfare20, code lawfare20.
Yeah, so there are a couple of things I want to pull out, especially in Nate's last remarks. I mean, I think this point about being very careful about what exactly it is that you would be deplatforming someone like Trump for, lest you end up bringing in a lot of other members of Congress, is a very important point. And I think we can just get more concrete and think about, for example, the case of someone like Maxine Waters, right, who's a Democrat and has been known to say some sort of inflammatory language. Obviously, I think if you put it in the context, it doesn't rise to the level of anything Trump has said. But for example, like after when during the trial of Derek Chauvin on the murder charge for George Floyd, she said that if the verdict comes back innocent, then the protesters should, quote unquote, get more confrontational. And she was roundly criticized, and I think fairly so for those remarks. And I guess my question, and I'll start with you, Nate, is, you know, on the one hand, one might say, well, we don't want to make the language, you know, we don't want to make it too broad in terms of when someone like Trump gets deplatformed. Maybe we don't want to go as far as Rick would go, right? Because then we would sweep someone like Maxine Waters under, you know, within it. But it does seem to me the opposite is to say, actually, we should have a much broader standard, you know, to so that A, we could enforce this in a sort of bipartisan way against all sorts of folks, and also to err on the side of speech that doesn't even come close to calling for violence or unrest, given the difficult time that we're in. So just to start with you, Nate, I mean, do you think that would be an acceptable compromise position? Or do you think ultimately that would just chill too much useful political speech under the First Amendment? Though, of course, again, being clear that none of this is government action, so this is all by analogy.
You have community standards and they need to be enforced, right? There is no kind of presidential exception to either the incitement policy or the glorification of violence policy, just like with its nudity policies or something like that. Now, there are some times where they, you know, public figures, the so-called cross-check system, and there were sometimes two tracks of rules because you have to pay attention to candidates in certain ways. But on what the community standards themselves required, right, it's a set of factors based on the text of the speech and the surrounding circumstances that would then lead to taking down of posts, filtering of posts, demotion of posts, or also taking down of accounts. And so I don't want to get into the whataboutism with like Maxine Waters and like, I mean, really specifically, the kind of speech that Trump gave himself is now orthodoxy for a large section of the Republican Party. And so that if you're going to take down Trump, you run the risk, and it's with a consistent standard, then you run the risk of going after a large number of elites in one of the political parties on Twitter or Facebook or any of these other platforms. And that is, I think, a problem for these platforms to be in. Now, look, if you think that this is the be-all and end-all of saving the Republic, right, and the extraordinary measures, just like, you know, we do in wartime when we, you know, think about speech in a different way when in the government sector. Well, if you believe that with social media, then their actions make sense. But I think this is a really, really difficult line to draw, and we need to be careful about whether the standard that was applied to Trump is actually the one we want them to apply secularly to all users of the platform, both in the United States and around the world.
I have two responses here. One is, I don't think we have to apply the same standard to, you know, the guy who's got, you know, 16 digits after his name that may or may not be a person that has four followers, as someone who is has millions of followers and is the leader of a political party. So I think we can say that just like the Texas and Florida laws purporting to regulate social media apply only to large social media platforms, I think we can apply things only to those with major followings or something like that without, I mean, I think that's a bright line rule. If you have over a million followers or whatever, the standard.
But can I ask, then what? What does that mean? So when you have a lot of people, followers, then a different set of community standards applies, or we should interpret them in a different way? I mean, I think I see where you're going with this, and I might agree, but it's like there is one set of community standards. And the question is, what is it about the level of followers that then leads you to interpret violations and punishments in a different way? And certainly it's going to be something about the capacity and propensity for harm, right? That actual harm. But then that is a very specific sort of narrow range of the kinds of comments that would be in violation of these community standards, right? And it requires a pretty complicated analysis on the part of the platform to estimate whether a given statement is going to lead to harm because it has a great amplification because of the number of followers.
Yeah, so I would analogize this to prosecutorial discretion. So the standard is the same, but you're going to pick the people who you want to make public examples of or who pose the greatest risk to society as the ones to prosecute. Now you could say, well, you know, that's having them exercise judgment. Exactly, that's fine. I have no problem exercising judgment. And again, in real time, I saw that wild tweet and I said, now is the moment to pull the plug. So some of us saw it. Now, if what this would mean is that you'd have large swaths of Republican elites of say over a million followers who'd be kicked off the platform for amplifying Trump's calls to violence, that's not a problem with the platform. That's a problem with the Republican Party. And so I have no problem saying if a party has been captured by authoritarian elements as a private company, you don't need to be a part of that. Just like Toyota should not be making contributions to election deniers, right? It's the same kind of argument. Again, they're private parties. They can choose what they want to do. But I think here's a place to draw the line. And a lot of corporations drew the line and said, we're not going to give to those members of Congress who voted to reject the Electoral College results from Arizona and Pennsylvania. Then, of course, they backtracked from it. Prosecutorial discretion, all of this is a question of discretion. And I think that we should have people, corporations acting as good citizens, good corporate citizens, good individuals, and make responsible choices, kind of the opposite of a kind of slapdash approach to all of this that we're seeing now from Elon Musk.
So I think you can perfectly justify the takedown of Donald Trump, but I don't think it can be done because of something like prosecutorial discretion. That scares me a little bit because that ends up being like the platform is in a somewhat unprincipled way going and selecting people for deplatforming, potentially in the heat of an election campaign. Now, I think that it might make sense to state publicly that, say, something like the strike system that these platforms use, whether you get three strikes and then you're out. You might say for someone with a very large following that when it comes to incitement or glorification of violence, instead of getting three strikes, you get one strike. You know, that we're so worried about the potential here that we would say, but you have to be transparent about it, that's the reason that you're deplatforming them is because of their greater capacity to cause real world harm. And then you'd have to have some indicia of that. And look, you know, this is true in First Amendment law also. When you think about incitement, the difficulty is you never really know when incitement's going to happen until it's too late. And so it's all well and good to say that when someone invites people to Washington because it's going to be wild, that we say either at the time you're willing to err on the side of preventing incitement to violence, or that after the fact we're saying, oh, it was a clear signal. But those kinds of people on Twitter say things like that all the time, some of them with very large followings. And so the question is, at what point do you want to be sort of over cautious with those particular accounts?
I do agree that ex ante. announcement of standards and escalation of penalties based upon warnings is definitely the way to go. And even-handedness. So if Biden would tweet the same thing as Trump, he would be treated the same way.
I really like the prosecutorial discretion analogy, actually, because it reminds me of the great Robert Jackson speech, The Federal Prosecutor, which was cited ad nauseum, I think it's fair to say, during the Trump administration, that has the famous line that the most dangerous power of the prosecutor is that he will pick people he thinks he should get rather than pick cases that need to be prosecuted. And I think that it gets to, obviously, the danger of that kind of system. And I think exactly what, you know, many Republicans, rightly or wrongly, have been claiming about these platforms. I do want to ask about the midterms, because part of obviously why we're concerned about Trump being let back on Twitter, part of why I think it's concerning that other Republican figures, like, for example, Arizona gubernatorial candidate Carrie Lake, are able to use these platforms to broadcast falsehoods, is because of the threat of misinformation undermining election integrity, the threat of violence. On the other hand, the 2022 midterms, at least from my perspective, went pretty smoothly. I was certainly concerned about what might happen, especially given figures like Lake promoting misinformation, reports about people with guns standing outside ballot drop boxes, also in Arizona. It was pretty violence-free. There was misinformation, but it didn't spread as broadly and as dangerously as it did in 2020. And so I'm curious how that affects both your analysis of Trump's role on these platforms, because on the one hand, I could say maybe our democracy is in less danger than we thought. So maybe letting him back on is less of a problem. On the other hand, maybe it was calmer because he wasn't there. So Nate, let me go to you first, and then Rick, I'm curious for your thoughts.
So I actually think that the relative sort of peacefulness of the midterms is what's going to lead Facebook to return him to the platform. That actually in the run-up to the election, particularly with the assault on Paul Pelosi, I thought there was going to be a, you know, good chance that they would still wait and see because the conditions of violence were such that it warranted him not being returned to the platform. And had we seen significant violence on election day, I think that the case would even be stronger. Now, since it went off without significant problems, then I think that they're going to be hard pressed not to return him to the platform. I know we'll get there, but I also want to emphasize this is not a binary decision, like to return or not to return. And that's part of that. That in some ways is the most interesting question, which is what are the conditions under which he might be returned, if any, and what would be the process for gradually reinstating him or gradually re-deplatforming him. I think are certain questions that are in the offing. But I do think the relative passivity of what happened in the 2022 election does factor into the way the platforms are going to think about this.
So I, too, am heartened by the environment in the midterms. I thought it was really important that a federal district court issued an order that stopped people with weapons and tactical gear from standing at ballot drop boxes in Arizona. I think, you know, it was just one case or two related cases, but that was an important signal that the law is going to be there. I thought it was heartening, too, that many of the election deniers, those who backed Trump's false claim that he actually had won the election, conceded their elections. Lake and a couple of the Secretary of State candidates are notable exceptions, but they didn't get traction. And so it leads me back to a question I often ask myself, how much is this a Trump-specific phenomenon versus how much does Trumpism have legs? So, you know, you didn't really see Carrie Lake having the power of the masses behind her. It's not like there was rioting in the streets of Phoenix over the election results. But it was a midterm election. Trump was not on the ballot. Trump is potentially on the ballot in 2024, at least in the primaries, at least so long as he runs. And I don't think we're out of the woods. It's good that we don't have election deniers running elections in swing states. But we did see some counties refusing to certify the vote and one of them having to go be sued in court. So we're not out of danger. What does this tell us about Trump being replatformed? I think you're right that the causality issue is really hard to measure here. Would there have been a greater potential for violence if Trump would have been out there egging people on about Carrie Lake's loss in Arizona? I don't know.
Let me just say one other thing on this, which is that we need to keep in mind that thousands of election deniers won office, right? It's not like just a few. Thousands had, and I mean, those who deny that the 2020, that Joe Biden was legitimately elected. So it's now part of, you know, the orthodoxy here that you would claim that the 2020 election was rigged. But yeah, I'm as heartened as all of us are that the most virulent of the election deniers, the most high profile ones, didn't end up winning. But, you know, we will wait and see for the reasons that Rick mentioned as to how significant that would be coming into 2024.
So I want to move our conversation now to the question of sort of where do we go from here? I mean, it sounds like, well, we know that Trump is back on Twitter. It sounds like, for the reasons both of you have articulated, Trump will probably come back to Facebook. And so the one question is sort of what do all the other platforms do? And what I wanted to ask, and I'm going to start with you, Nate, is, you know, does it have to be the same, or should it be the same policy or principles across different platforms, you know, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, TikTok, you know, whatever the case is? And you know, does it also depend in part on sort of something you said before, which is that, look, it's not a binary on or off. You can bring him back partially. You can have pre-review, theoretically, is something I remember you all talked about in the conference, which obviously has its own complications. So I'm just sort of curious if you could get into a little bit more, start with you and then to Rick, about the diversity of approaches going forward.
So I think there are several different approaches you could take in reinstating him, as well as in re-deplatforming if necessary. And so there are many half measures that you can do. One is that you only allow him to be on the platform, but you don't amplify any of the content. Another is you allow him to be on the platform in certain respects, but you don't allow him to pay for ads, which could be in some ways the most important thing, particularly Facebook. Trump is not really Facebook is not his preferred platform. Twitter certainly was. But when it comes to raising money as a candidate, Facebook is a much more effective platform than other platforms. And I think that, you know, that's one of the reasons he would definitely want to be on it. And I think that you could, as I mentioned at the conference, as you hinted here, you could have a kind of pre-review, pre-clearance idea. This is something that Evelyn Dueck, my colleague at Stanford, has also argued for, on the idea that you could say, yes, you're on the platform, but we'll have a 2-hour review period for anything that you put up. And we should have, you know, full-time and professional employees who are in charge of these presidential accounts. And frankly, it's not clear to me, you might even want to apply that to all candidates, right? You could say that this pre-review for community standards violations, what would be a prior restraint under First Amendment law and clearly prohibited to the government. But nevertheless, you could say, look, we're so worried as a platform of what candidates are going to do that we're not going to allow instantaneous posting. That seems perfectly reasonable to me. And so those are just some of the different ways that you could affect things on the front end. Then on the back end, you could say, look, you are reinstated, but here are the, you know, we're going to have a 1-strike rule instead of a 3-strike rule for you, right? You know, and be very clear about what the kind of system of probation would entail. And so you could gradually, you know, have him on the platform as well as have different rules that would apply once he was on there. And I don't just mean this for Trump. This could be true for anybody who's deplatformed, that you need to have, is there some period through which, or some process through which, you can essentially earn your position back?
I think that this raises interesting questions if you're Trump, of why you would agree to special conditions to come back. And you could actually make it a whole issue that, you know, that they're treating you unfairly. No one has ever been treated more unfairly than I have by such a system. I think the most important thing for the platforms to do that are going to restore Trump, and obviously Elon Musk is not going to do this, but those that are taking content moderation choices seriously, is to articulate in advance what those rules are going to be, whatever they're going to be. Here's how many strikes, here's what's allowed, here's what's not allowed, and make those publicly available. One of the things we know about Facebook is that they had a different set of standards for their VIPs, They were allowed to do things that would have violated the terms of service. Kind of the opposite of the point. I was saying hold them to a higher standard. It seems that Facebook was holding them to a lower standard. I think there need to be clear, articulated, not just articulable, articulated standards to apply.
I mean, that gets to the question of just how to articulate those standards, though. And I know this is something that you all talked about at the conference. I mean, is there a formulation that you have in mind other than saying something like, you know, no incitement to violence that perhaps seems easier in retrospect, as we've discussed, to determine than it is ex ante and could also, you know, lead to those same accusations we've been talking about platforms making decisions, you know, picking and choosing perhaps unfairly. Is there a framework that you have in mind or a sort of a structure for how platforms might specify that?
Well, let's just start with what might be an uncomfortable fact, which is it's not clear to me that Trump's speeches on January 6th or in the lead up actually violated the community standards of the platforms. I mean, this is something that is like we can make arguments back and forth. We certainly are going to need evidence extraneous to the speech itself in order to come to that conclusion. And so, you know, if I today were to say, come to Washington, it's going to be wild, clearly that's not a violation of the community standards. You have to say, well, given everything that's led to this point, there's a greater likelihood of violence. And using the word wild, which is otherwise perfectly fine on the platform, now seems like it's saying, let's go and invade or kill people or something, you know, classic declarations of incitement. Those hoops that you have to jump through that I just described are, you know, ones that are extremely fraught. And again, you have to think about, because you said, well, can we do something with the standards? It's like, no, you can't do anything with the standards. The standards are what they are. They're going to apply internationally to all kinds of figures. You're going to either have to develop a bespoke set of standards for either this political leader, political leaders in general, or political leaders that you think are going to have a greater likelihood to incite or to cause lawbreaking or physical harm. And so, look, for example, at incitement standards in the law. And then look, for instance, even at what the January 6th committee is going to end up trying to deal with. It's extremely difficult to tie a particular speech, say that Trump gave, to what ended up happening. That's not to say that it wasn't perfectly in line with it, right? And I think we could, as private platforms, come up with rules that are extremely risk averse. But those aren't the rules that they have, because these are rules that are applying outside the context of elections, outside the context of insurrections, have to apply in India and Brazil as well as in the United States. And so I don't think they've thought through these issues of how to refine the community standards, and they've come up with what they have. And frankly, most of the platforms have converged over the last 10 years to a very similar type of community standards.
So I actually wrote up what I think the standard should be for purposes of this conference, and people can find this on, if they search SSRN, I wrote a piece called Donald Trump Should Remain Deplatformed from Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube, despite the high bar that platforms should apply to the question of deplatforming political figures. And here's my standard. I'll just read it. Given the strong interest in free speech and access by voters to the speech of candidates, office holders, and other significant political figures, platforms should impose a very high bar to the question of removal or exclusion. Candidates should face removal or deplatforming only if they pose a significant risk to the stability of democracy or foment hatred that poses a significant risk of causing social strife or violence. In particular, candidates should be excluded from platforms only if they show a consistent pattern of 1, suggesting violence as a means of taking power or resolving election disputes, 2, falsely claiming without reliable evidence that an upcoming or past election is or will be stolen or rigged, and 3, engaging in hate speech against racial, ethnic, religious, and sexual or other groups. So I think Trump violated those rules well before January 6th and would have been deplatformed under those rules.
All right, let's leave it there and give you the last word, Rick. Thanks to both of you for joining us. And we will see if Trump ends up back on Twitter in the coming months.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Arbiters of Truth, a Lawfare podcast series in the online information ecosystem. You can find past episodes in the Lawfare podcast feed and in our separate Arbiters of Truth podcast feed. The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. You can get ad-free versions of this and other Lawfare podcasts by becoming a Lawfare Material supporter at patreon.com/lawfare. You'll also get access to special events and other content available only to our supporters. This podcast is edited by Jen Pacha Howell, and your audio engineer this episode was Kara Schillen of Goat Rodeo. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thanks for listening.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.